I was happy to be headed to Athens and away from Silas, Luke, and Timothy for a while. As a young man, I had studied Athens and its philosophers and had always wanted to see the famous city.
The second part of his second missionary journey started when Paul entered Greece for the first time. Paul's first stop was Athens, a famous tourist destination now, just as it was then.
I left the city of Berea and the province of Macedonia and entered into the province of Greece. A few hard days of walking later, I found a shell of the Athens I had read about in its golden age. It had been almost 400 years since the great builders and philosophers had done things nobody had ever done or thought. The Acropolis was covered with run-down temples and buildings. Even the Parthenon, the most beautiful building ever created, was shabby. The Romans had been stealing Greek marble, statues, and ideas for more than 100 years, and the Greeks were helpless in stopping them. The city had shrunk to only 10,000 inhabitants. I climbed the steep Acropolis to look down on the city. On its Areopagus, the rocky outcrop known as Mars Hill, I looked down at a dying city and its people, all of them living in the distant past with long dead ideas and philosophies, such emptiness and hopelessness, I nearly cried. Behind me was the top of the Acropolis with its many temples, including the giant Parthenon, dedicated to the city's patron goddess, Athena. In front of me was the Agora with its rows of shops and statues. I descended to the marketplace and I saw something that broke my heart, an altar dedicated to the unknown god. These Athenians are so clueless. And just so they could cover all the bases, they had an altar to the unknown god. More than five centuries before my time, Greece and Macedonia were not countries, but an area with many city-states and small kingdoms, Athens, Sparta, Thebes, Corinth. And these city-states constantly fought against each other and against other enemies in other countries in order to improve the chances of winning wars and growing economically. Each area created their own gods that they worshiped and eventually ended up with a very comprehensive set of myths concerning these so-called gods. You've probably heard of many of the Greek gods: Zeus, Poseidon, Athena, Aphrodite, Nike. Eventually, the Romans would revise the Greek myths and change the names of the gods, but they essentially continued the same pagan worship. And the purpose of religion for the Greeks and Romans was to improve prosperity of their city-states and their families. Their religious celebrations often included drunkenness and prostitution. They had no concept of a religion that was used to worship a true God and to act in a holy and pure way. Instead, they used philosophy to modify people's thoughts and behaviors. I taught in the synagogue and on the streets of Athens and was confronted with the same old philosophies and laws that had been argued and found wanting for hundreds of years. Stoicism, Epicureanism, Cynicism, had all failed their followers. As I proclaimed the good news of our resurrected Lord, I found many people who were relieved to finally hear a message of hope and life. At one point, I was invited to speak before the Areopagus Council. Now, this group of men presided over cases of murder, sacrilege, and arson. I presumed that I could have been convicted of sacrilege and punished by being shoved over the edge. However, the council was convinced by my sincerity and beliefs and allowed me to stay and teach in Athens. My speech to them was based on natural theology instead of Old Testament scriptures. Even from that point of view, the truth of Jesus was so obvious that many who heard the gospel became believers. Perhaps you find many people who are ignorant of the Old and New Testament. If so, study my speech in Athens and use it as a guide, using nature and popular writers and other common information to convince people of the truth of Jesus and God. You should become all things to all people in order to win them to Christ. In the end, many in the audience wanted to hear more about Jesus, though I suspect many of them just wanted to hear about a new and interesting philosophy. In the end, many people heard the word, but only a few became believers. They took their sweet time about it, but Silas and Timothy finally joined me in Athens. And based on their stories, I decided it was prudent to send them back to Thessalonica to strengthen the church there. They had proven their mettle, and I knew I could trust them to do what was needed. And Silas was wearing me out, wanting to taste the latest Greek food in the Athens Agora. After a few weeks, when my work at Athens came to an end, the Holy Spirit led me on a 50-mile walk to Corinth. Oh, the land and the sea views were astounding. The Aegean Sea, I don't think I've ever seen anything prettier than seeing the blue sky and clouds reflected off of that island-studded water. 200 years before my time, Corinth and Rome were vying for control of the area. Rome defeated Corinth and totally destroyed it in 146 BC. And the Romans hauled away unimaginable amounts of wealth and art from the city. 100 years later, the Romans rebuilt the city in a slightly different place and made it the provincial capital of Greece. And like Athens and the rest of Greece, Corinth was just a shell of what it had been in its prime. Although in my time, Corinth was a much bigger and more important city than Athens. Corinth controlled the Isthmus of Corinth that allowed travelers to avoid sailing around the dangerous Peloponnese Peninsula. It had a port on either side of the Isthmus, and people always wanted to dig a 4-mile-long canal across the Isthmus, but it wasn't until the 1800s that somebody did it. Unfortunately, that canal was built too small and couldn't accommodate the larger shipping vessels, so it was almost instantly useless. As a seaport city, though, there were some rough characters in Corinth, with entertainments of all kinds readily available. Corinth was also famous for its temple of Aphrodite, which was little more than a brothel for the priests and priestesses that worked there. No city in the Roman Empire needed the gospel more than Corinth. Corinth was where I met Aquila and Priscilla, a Jewish couple who had been expelled from Rome because of the Emperor Claudius' order for all Jews to leave Rome. We were all tent makers, and they offered to let me live with them because they thought we might help each other. And soon, they became believers. They became some of my best pupils because they loved the scriptures and God wholeheartedly. I worked with them and evangelized others whenever I could take time off to do so. It was a refreshing time for me, working with my hands. I was able to quit worrying about all the churches we had established and gave my body time to heal from all the beatings. Silas and Timothy joined me at Corinth with special gifts from the believers in Macedonia and Greece, and I became financially able to devote all my time to teaching. And they brought a good report from Thessalonica. But it was apparent that the believers needed to hear some words from me. I wrote one letter to the Thessalonians and reminded them that they needed to work to stay pure until Christ came back. Like many Greeks and Romans, the Thessalonians were very free in sexual matters and had to be continually reminded to stay pure. Later, I had to write another letter to them to clarify more things and to correct some of their beliefs about the second coming. They were sincere, but they had been greatly influenced by the pagan world around them, and they were always looking for loopholes so they could lead undisciplined lives. After a while, the Jews in Corinth became so contentious that I decided to concentrate all of my efforts on the Gentiles. We stayed in Corinth for a year and a half, and we made an incredible number of friends and believers. Our little church family often met in the home of Gaius, and I specifically remember that Crispus and Sosthenes, leaders of the synagogue, became believers, as well as Erastus. And one of the few people I personally baptized, Stephanus, became a believer and later became an effective church leader. And we sometimes had a little excitement in Corinth, such as the time the Jews tried to have us expelled from the city. The case came before Gallio, who was the brother of the famous Roman philosopher, Seneca. Gallio heard the case and immediately dismissed it because no Roman law had been broken. He was so irritated with the Jews that he ejected everyone from the court. The argument broke out among the Jews and the words escalated into a violent beating for the synagogue leader, Sosthenes. Rather than break up the fight, Gallio showed no concern whatsoever. Silas could not contain his smile. Finally, he was not the one taking the beating. I didn't know it at the time, but part of the reason the Holy Spirit had us stay so long in Corinth was to train Priscilla and Aquila to be great evangelists. Their style of teaching was much more peaceful than mine, and admittedly, for many people, it was more effective. And when my time in Corinth was over, the Holy Spirit decided that Priscilla, Aquila, and I should sail to Ephesus in the province of Asia, modern-day Turkey. It was in Ephesus that Priscilla and Aquila began to show their value to the Lord. A very powerful preacher named Apollos came from Alexandria to tell the people about the good news. Unfortunately, he was only aware of the baptism of John, so he was teaching inaccurately, unlike the way I would have done it. They quietly invited Apollos into their home and explained the baptism of Jesus and the Holy Spirit. From then on, Apollos became such a powerful preacher that nobody could refute him. And the Holy Spirit decided that I needed to end this journey. So I left Priscilla and Aquila in Ephesus for them to continue their teaching. And I went to Caesarea, Jerusalem, and back to my home base in Antioch. Once again, the Holy Spirit was acting in an unpredictable manner and was setting up for long-term growth in the kingdom. Now, reading my missionary account from a distance of 2,000 years, it may seem disjointed. Most people see the Bible as people and letters and single point events that don't connect very well. If you ask 10 people what year I was in Corinth the first time, I bet you few of them could place it within 10 years. Spring of 51 AD to the spring of 52 AD, when Gallio was proconsul. But scholars still aren't sure whether I started or ended my tenure in Corinth during that time, so they can't date it exactly, which is important because that's one of the key exact dating points of my entire career that Luke gives you. He always liked to be a bit mysterious. People also tend to separate my letters from my life and from the lives of those I knew. The story of my life is the story of meeting people, developing relationships, and dealing with churches throughout much of the Roman Empire. Real people with the same problems you have today. Much of my ministry depended on developing close relationships with many, many people. The man who was once the angriest person in Israel learned how to make friends and influence people I was the Jewish Dale Carnegie. Oh, God has such a sense of humor.